Hey guys, and welcome to episode 70 of the OCDstories.com podcast. Now, this episode is the first of a three-part series on where I'll be interviewing OCD charities. Now, I'm interviewing what I consider the three biggest OCD charities. I could be wrong, but I think these are the three biggest. Why I got them on, because I wanted them to kind of sell themselves to you so you know what services they have to offer and also how you can get involved with the community or help keeping these great organizations going. So episode one of this series is with the IOCDF, which is the International OCD Foundation. Now I interviewed Jeff Szymanski and Ethan Smith. Jeff is the executive director of the IOCDF and clinical psychologist. And Ethan is an actor, writer, and he is also an ambassador for the IOCDF, where he goes around the country doing great work, raising awareness for OCD, breaking stigma, and helping people get their lives back. And I had a good conversation with these guys. We first get into their kind of stories, whether it's, you know, why Jeff got into being a clinical psychologist and why. How OCD presented itself to him and how he recovered. And it was great to hear both those. And then we find out more about the charity, about how they can help you, how you can get involved with them, etc. And we end on a few fun questions around kind of what is an amazing life and the one bit of advice they have for someone suffering with OCD. So I think you'll enjoy this. We also have an episode of OCD Action and OCD UK coming up in the future. So without further ado, here is Jeff and Ethan. On the podcast today from the International OCD Foundation, I have Jeff Szymanski, IOCDF Executive Director, and Ethan Smith, IOCDF Ambassador. Welcome to the show, guys.
Thanks so much for having
me. It's good to get you on. As I mentioned before, I'm doing it with the main OCD charities in the Western world, and mainly because I can't speak Chinese or anything else. I want to find out more because you guys do a lot of in the OCD community. You're a big part in driving some research. I'm doing a systematic review at the minute on acceptance and commitment therapy, looking at obviously treating OCD. And I saw that you guys funded one of Michael Tuhig's studies. So it's good to see you guys there. And so I guess before we get started, it'd be good to hear a little bit about both of your stories, whether it's OCD or whether it's how you got into therapy, doing therapy.
Ethan, I'll let you start.
Cool. Oh, I'll start. So I am I'm an OCD sufferer. I was born with OCD, and I'm currently 39 years old, so I've had it my whole life. It was pretty debilitating most of my life. I was able to roughly function till about early 30s, and then that's when things took a serious turn and I was bedridden. After that, I finally discovered some life-changing treatment that was exposure response prevention, ERP, in addition to ACT, acceptance commitment therapy, and some DBT. And now my life is amazing, and I live in Los Angeles, write, direct, produce, and I'm gratefully the national ambassador to the IOCDF. So get to now give back and make sure my story isn't everyone else's story.
Yeah, that's really good to hear. And Jeff, what about yourself?
So I'm a clinical psychologist by training, actually, and I worked with people with OCD at the OCD Institute at McLean Hospital from 2001 to 2008, and then moved to the foundation in 2008 as the executive director, have been here since then. So my job is not only to kind of run the organization, but to make sure that people are being educated. So I continue to do trainings, I do supervision, wrote a book on perfectionism, all that kind of good stuff.
Yeah. Okay, excellent. And how long have you both been involved with IOCDF?
I've been involved as an ambassador in that capacity since 2014.
Okay, cool.
And I, behavior therapist and then the director of psychological services at the Institute. I was attending conferences and was a member of the foundation back in 2004 and then started as the ED in 2008.
Okay, excellent.
And I did, yeah, I joined it in 2010. My first conference was 2011.
Okay, fantastic. Yeah, I would talk about the conference later, actually. So give everyone the information so if they want to attend, or good to find out if they can't attend this year, maybe they can next. Okay, great. So I guess from both your perspectives, tell us about the International OCD Foundation.
Yeah, I'll start here because I wanted Ethan to introduce himself first, because that is really the impetus for the OCD Foundation. It was started by people with OCD back in 1986. A group of patients were at Yale University inpatient, and they were part of some of the first medication trials in looking at what might be a good treatment for OCD. And the psychiatrist who was running that unit, running the study, Wayne Goodman, encouraged them to meet as a group while they were on the unit. They found that so helpful that after they left, they continued to meet, and that formed the original Obsessive Compulsive Foundation back in 1986, with Wayne Goodman as the first chair of their scientific advisory board. And then it stayed in Connecticut, in the U.S., until 2007, when it moved up to 2008, and that's when I got involved. But what is unusual and fantastic about this organization is that we really do solicit and involve every member of the OCD and related disorders community. So we have some of the biggest researchers in the world associated with us, as long as the top trainers and therapists, as well as people with OCD, hoarding disorder, body dysmorphic disorder, what we call the body repetitive focused behaviors, so skin picking and hair pulling disorder. So it's people that are living with the disorder, their friends, their family members, and again, then we have the mental health community. So that's true at our conference, that's true on our website, that's true in our community, that's true on our board of directors. We have everyone represented on our board of directors, and I think that's a really cool aspect of the organization.
Yeah, no, indeed. And Ethan, from your point of view?
For me, it's all about, I think, education, breaking stigma, getting the word out, you know, breaking sort of the public opinion of what OCD is, how it affects people. You know, that it's a bit of a kitschy thing right now, kind of cool to have it.
Yeah.
So from my perspective, it's all about, you know, getting the word out and education, like I said, and truly making this a movement and making treatment affordable and effective, and people can be able to get it in wherever they live, you know, accessible. I knew it was three A's: accessible, affordable, and effective. But effective doesn't start with an A, so there you go. So for me, that's really what it's all about, is you know, being somebody that others can relate to, because I still struggle to, and be able to have that common bond and share and make you know.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's really good. And I think the thing you said about OCD being sort of kitschy at the minute, or it's kind of on trend. I'm rewatching all, is it 10 seasons of Friends? Because I've, you know, throughout the years I've seen replays on TV, but I've never watched it all the way through, and for whatever reason I've got some time. And obviously Monica's very, she's a neat freak. She's anal, you could say. And if that, I thought to myself, if that was recorded now, I guarantee you the jokes would be about her having OCD, or which, yeah, I found interesting that back then, when it was the 90s, it wasn't done, and the early 2000s. So is this something you guys have seen kind of it definitely progress? Because the whole time I've known, or at least the last sort of 5 to 7 years, it's definitely been a thing. Whereas before that, I don't really remember it.
Yeah, I actually like your review of the history of it, because fortunately and unfortunately, in the 90s, we had What Monk, and we had As Good As It Gets, and it got OCD on the public radar. But yeah, then unfortunately, it did morph in terms of what it was to what how the media was portraying it as. And so whenever I do media, the first thing I do is to educate people about kind of the problem of the term obsessive compulsive disorder, right? Because obsessive is a lay language public usage, but it means something very different when we're talking about being obsessive. I'm obsessed with a baseball team. I'm obsessed with a color. That is not what it means to have an obsession in OCD. Mm. I compulsively rearrange my closet. I compulsively collect baseball cards. That's not what it means to have compulsive behavior in OCD. And so Monica from Friends was obsessive. She was compulsive. But we talk a lot about in a lot of our media, a lot of our messaging, and what Ethan does such a great job of is what does the D actually mean? It means disorder. It means impairment. It means I'm not living my life the way I want to. I'm not, these aren't quirks. These aren't preferences. This is incapacitating me. And so I'm not obsessive. I'm not compulsive. I actually have a disorder where it's interfering with my ability to live my life. And so we reach out to folks like Ethan, who are really gifted at putting a face to what OCD actually means.
Yeah, no, that's really good. And I see the stuff usually through Jeff Bell or Charlotte Nicely on Facebook that you guys do. So, Jeff, I've seen you a few times on my Facebook feed, raising awareness, which is great. Mm-hmm. Okay, great. So next question is... what services do you guys offer? And that's a very general question, but if someone comes to you with OCD, what would they expect to find?
Yeah, so I'll give kind of the broad overview and then let Ethan talk a little bit more about a big piece of what we do he's involved in. But kind of the broad brushstrokes to what we do here is, number one, we're a primary resource and a warehouse for people that are looking for information about OCD. So everything on our website, from introductory information to more advanced information, is all written by our scientific and clinical advisory board. We edit it and make sure that it's a little bit more accessible to the average person, because all these doctors love speaking in all their 10-cent words. Yeah. So we do want to make sure that it's accessible and engaging and informative. So we have websites. We have our primary website. That's just about OCD. We have a website specifically for pediatric OCD. We have a website for body dysmorphic disorder and a website for hoarding disorder. And then we do a number of other kinds of complementary things, like informational brochures, our newsletter, those kinds of things. One of our bigger programs is the conference that you mentioned. This is an opportunity for all members of our community to get together and teach each other and learn from each other. So Ethan has spoken many times at our conference. He was our keynote speaker at one point. And what I hear when people are coming out of a professional coming out of a talk that was given by someone suffering with the disorder, they come away with this idea of, I've never quite heard the story told that way, because I'm trying to do treatment and you kind of get in this relationship with someone. And someone like Ethan is very good at... again, giving that kind of bigger picture perspective. So we have therapists and researchers that give talks, and we have family members and people struggling with the disorder give talks. So some are panelists and sometimes they're attendees. We also do a variety of different kinds of trainings through the foundation, whether they're online trainings or in-person trainings. We do a lot of research grant funding. So we've given out about $3.5 million over the past several years. We typically give out about three grants a year, and they can range from OCD treatment to causes of OCD to pediatric OCD. We've given out hoarding grants before. You mentioned Michael Tuig. Acceptance and commitment therapy is seen as kind of an up-and-coming avenue for folks that maybe aren't responding to traditional first-line treatments like exposure response prevention or the SSRIs. So we funded a grant where it was looking at how to make ERP more effective by incorporating acceptance and commitment therapy principles. We also work with people around the country. So we have about 23 affiliates in the United States. So they're either city or statewide groups that are doing similar kinds of programming that we're doing on a national level, they do on a local level. And then you were mentioning OCD Action and OCD UK. They're two of our global partners, but we've helped set up groups in China and Japan. We're working with some folks in India, in the Middle East. So there are actually about a dozen of these groups around the world that we also partner with, and primarily work with them during our OCD Awareness Week in the second week of October to help spread awareness about, again, what OCD really is. And then a big part of our program that I want Ethan to talk about is we had had spokespeople. He was one of our spokespeople, and we've kind of transitioned that into an ambassador program. So I will turn that over to Ethan.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a beautiful transition, Jeff. I would just want to mention one thing about the website. I think one of the most useful things on the website, aside from all the resources and doctors and things like that, is there's a questionnaire on questions you can ask doctors to make sure that they're appropriate psychologists to treat OCD, because like me and many others, it's hardly an original story. I spent years and years and years going to therapists that said they knew how to treat OCD, but had no clue, and wasted time, wasted effort, wasted tons of money, and also just hope. You know, by the time I got to the place that could really help me, you know, I truly believed there was no way. So on there's great questions you can ask therapists that you're trying to find and weed out and make a good decision for yourself. As far as what we're doing some very cool things as far as ambassadorships and advocacy. Dr. Michael Jenneke, you may know the name, he's sort of the foremost authority psychiatrist on OCD. And early on, he made a statement that said, you know, the best thing you can do for OCD is help others. To help your OCD is help others. And I've found that 1,000% true. The more I talk to people, the more I help others. The more I find I'm reminded of things that I need to do and stay on top of. And so with that, we have an amazing community that's very passionate about being involved, and they want to advocate on a variety of levels. You know, I've decided to come out extremely publicly and talk vulnerably about my story. That may not be everybody. So we wanted to create a campaign and an initiative and a movement and opportunities for individuals and sufferers and friends and family to be able to advocate on a level that they want, that they feel comfortable with, in order to give back and sort of change the conversation globally. So we're in the very beginning stages of implementing this ambassador program, where we'll have ambassadors and advocates on a variety of different topics, ranging from education and outreach to teens and young adults to diversity in OCD. And the goal there is to roll out multiple projects within those categories year-round and have opportunities for people to advocate, change the messaging worldwide, spread the word, break the stigma, educate, and really make a difference. I really truly believe that mental health, you know, is the next big conversation, sort of like LGBTQ is right now. And I think that's what's going to be necessary in order to change public perception and opinion of mental illness, not just OCD, but all sufferers, and that it's not just a matter of willpower or making a choice. It's a disease, just like cancer, diabetes, and like that, you know, we need to get help and not be afraid to talk about it for, you know, for fear of being shunned. So we're really excited to roll out this ambassador program. I think it's going to be amazing and really helpful. Yeah,
a big part of our mission is to tell the truth about OCD, not just so that the general public understands it better, but so that people suffering with it, people affected by it, family members, know that they need to get treatment. The best way to reduce stigma is to tell these personal stories. Yeah. And so by doing that, OCD is one of the most isolating illnesses I can think of, because for most people, they can hide it. They choose to, because for most people, they recognize I'm thinking things, feeling things, and doing things that I don't even want to be doing. And so it's an incredibly isolating disorder. So to have people come out and tell their story and advocate and get involved in a way that they feel comfortable with is hugely important and a big part of our mission.
Yeah, no, I 100% agree with that. As you say, the secret illness is its kind of nickname, and it's something I definitely hid as a child. I didn't say anything, and for fear of being insane. Or even that is not the end of the world, because of the right medication and therapy now that's treatable. So it's great to hear what you guys are doing, and it's good to hear the things that are coming up. And I'll link in the show notes for anyone listening to the resources you've mentioned. Is there a page on the site as well that links to all the affiliates you guys have?
Yep, right on our homepage, under the About Us. It'll tell you about all the affiliates, and it'll bring you to a page. All of them have websites, and they all have their own individual resources that they've been building. We have some that are brand new and some that have been around for 20 years.
Wow. Cool. Excellent. Okay, so we covered the conference. So how can people get more involved in the charity, be it financially or with their time?
I mean, there's a number of ways. One is, if you want to be a member. So a lot of our professional members, it is a way for them to be listed in our resource directory. If you're not a professional, but you want to be involved as a member, that just kind of is, has you become part of a community, gets you signed up for our newsletter that goes out quarterly. It's about research and therapy updates. It's personal stories. It's any programming that is upcoming on our end. But I do think, you know, and Ethan has spearheaded this as our national ambassador, these calls to action. And so there is a web page on our website that is an opportunity for people to sign up as what we call an OCD advocate. And so a grassroots advocate around OCD. And Ethan and his team of ambassadors are going to come up with different calls to action and challenges that people can engage in. And you don't have to be any more involved in the organization than just being an OCD advocate. But one that was very successful this past year was Ethan had reached out to all of our OCD advocates and said, you know, I was in residential treatment over the holidays and it was pretty depressing. And wouldn't it be nice if someone just sent you a card and you got a little bit of encouragement over the holidays? And so we had our OCD advocates all write holiday cards, and we sent them to all the residential facilities. And so all the patients over the holidays got just that nice boost if someone is thinking about you, kind of sharing in that struggle a little bit. And so there's all kinds of things that I think Ethan and his group will come up with that will be impactful and engaging in that way.
Yeah, no, that's really good to hear. Did you get much feedback from that? Did you have return addresses they could respond to?
You know, I actually did put my email in the cards that I sent, and I did get a couple responses from people just thanking me and that it really made a difference. It feels, you know, residential treatment for OCD feels very lonely and isolating, despite the fact that it's nothing like, you know, an acute psychiatric locked facility or anything like that. The majority of the residential programs are homey feeling, and you know, they're open, you know, open campus, and aside from participating in the groups and your therapy, you know, you can go and do what you please. But at the end of the day, you still registered as I'm in a mental hospital, you know, and that's sort of a voice that screams in your head every minute of every day, especially during the holidays. You know, I remember going on outings and we go to the mall, and it was just so painful because you'd walk around the mall, everybody's with their families visiting Santa Claus or, you know, buying presents for everybody. And here you are with a group of people and, you know, yes, you're out and yes, you're living and yes, you're getting help, but you can't get past the point. And honestly, you buy into the stigma of mental health. I'm not, you know, I remember, I didn't know then, but even if it were today, you know, I would walk around and go, yes, I know I'm taking my medicine like I'm supposed to, but I'm in a mental hospital, and what would people think of that, and how do I feel about that? So, I mean, I think the cards were a really great idea, and, you know, Jeff and I collaborated on coming up with that project, but it was such a great idea on personalizing, you know, their experience and giving them hope on a level, not just from a professional level, but from a personal level, and let them know that, you know, they really are just doing what's necessary to live full and amazing lives, no different than getting your chemo. You know, people getting chemo, most, they may be embarrassed by the symptoms, but it's kind of understood that that's what you do for cancer, and nobody shuns anybody for going to get chemotherapy. But if I said, oh, I was in a mental hospital getting treatment for OCD, I would probably get a look. In fact, since becoming a national ambassador, dating has become really complicated because I do online dating and stuff, and everybody Google stalks or whatever. Mm. And so originally I was an actor, and so when people Googled me, all my acting stuff came up, and they were like, hey, you were in this. I talked to a girl like a year ago, and the first thing she said was, this was our first phone conversation. Hi, So I have a question. You were in a mental hospital? And I was like, oh, this is a great way to open the conversation. Yeah. You know, but it turned out to be fine. And it's just part of everything. But it's important to make people understand that, you know, it's an illness. And we need help in medicine just like everybody else and to lead normal functional lives.
Yeah, and what's interesting about that, too, just to piggyback on that, Ethan, is that we recently got someone sent us a video. It was a monologue group that she was part of at a university in the States. And her talk, it was just a 5-minute talk, and her talk was about having OCD. And the statistics are, which she quoted, is 1 out of 100 people have OCD. So she said, if I'm in a room with 100 people, I'm the girl with OCD. And she said, but then imagine being in a room with 100 people and all of them have OCD. What would that be like? And she says, actually, there is a place like that. And it's the IOCDF conference. And she said, when you're in a room with people with OCD, everyone has OCD. She says, then you're just you. It's the first time you're really you.
Yeah.
And you're the reader and you're the, you know, sports fanatic and you're the, you know, girl who likes cats. You aren't the girl with OCD. And there's something so normalizing about that. And it is upsetting to me on a daily basis that people with OCD have to have that as a revelation experience of there's someone else out there like me. Again, because this community unfortunately ends up being so isolated that the community that we provide ends up being very curative and normalizing and holding for a lot of people. But as Ethan was saying, you know, there's so much support for most medical illnesses because most medical illnesses are, you're a victim of cancer, right?
Yeah.
With mental illness, there's still this idea that you did something to earn it or lack of character or bad parenting or no. For people with OCD, they didn't ask for this. This happened to them, just like cancer happened to people with cancer.
And I do want to say, you know, my approach to people that are unaware or uneducated is with love and compassion. Because at the end of the day, 99% of the people that don't have OCD and don't know simply don't know because they're uneducated, because the word hasn't gotten out, because it's not mainstream. And I think a lot of us as sufferers are quick to get angry when somebody says, I'm so OCD, because we think about, I was bedridden for 8 months and lost 100 pounds. And so, like, how could you say that? I was literally about to die. But it's still important to remind ourselves that, you know, most people just don't know, and they're quoting what they hear on TV, and they in no way mean it maliciously. And I found that when you address it with compassion and love and understanding and educate them, they're very open-minded. Oh, I had no idea. Oh my gosh, that's really interesting. Can you tell me more? Plane rides for me are always very a lot of fun, full of that. But so I think that's important too for OCD sufferers and their families to understand is to not be as reactive and approach it with, you know, mindfulness.
Yeah. Yeah. Very good point. I mean, we're all ignorant about something. Mm-hmm. No one knows everything. And as you say,
speak for yourself, Ben.
Yeah. Yeah. Fair point. But yeah, as you say, as we educate people, then most people will, you know, oh, sorry, I never realized, and et cetera, et cetera.
Exactly.
Yeah. Cool. All right. So a couple general questions now. So to each one of you, you meet someone with OCD or they come up to you because they know who you are. Maybe they've seen you on this podcast and they just want one piece of advice, your best advice you've got for them. What is it?
What's that, Jeff? You want to go first? Go ahead.
God, it's not a piece of advice. It is get educated about what OCD is, get educated about what the treatment is. And you would never go to a car dealership and buy the first car that you test drove. So don't do that with a therapist. Make sure that a therapist that you are working with is a good fit for you. So that would be my overarching advice.
Good advice, yeah.
I think the advice would come after this statement, which is there is hope. And I don't care who you are, where you come from, how old you are, what you have, how severe your OCD is, there is hope. And hope comes in the form of stigma reduction, education, proper treatment, healthy treatment. And, you know, just because ERP didn't work the first time doesn't mean it's not going to work the second time. You know, there's so many factors and so much personalization that goes into the therapy. So it really is a persistent and consistent therapy, and you have to stay at it. But I don't think anyone is beyond getting better and sort of finding their stride in life. So for me, it's really important. OCD is such a hopeless illness. I mean, you get to that place where you just don't see a light at the end of the tunnel anymore. And I've been there, and I know so many sufferers are. So for me, letting people know and using my story as proof that if I can get better, you can too. Not saying that, you know, but it's very important for me to get that across so people, you know, can go into therapy and treatment truly believing that they can get better, because a willingness for change is really key to eventually leading a healthy, normal life. I use normal life.
You know, so. Yeah, good point. Good advice as well, guys. And lastly, last question. So for me, recovery, and you alluded it to before even, is recovery isn't just about kind of kicking OCD to the curb or getting it into check. It's about living a fulfilling life, or the question I always say is an amazing life. So what advice do you have to people who want to live an amazing life?
Yeah, I mean, I think living in recovery is much like maintaining physical health. I don't think there's any different. Just like somebody would go to the gym four times a week and eat healthy, and they may cheat on a day or two, but at the end of the day, they've adopted it as a lifestyle, not a diet.
Yeah.
And I think OCD recovery is very much the same way. Once you've put in those hours and possibly years in the therapy, and you get to a place where you're sort of coming down the Mount Everest, we've all felt the climb and then we get to come down.
Yeah.
You move into that place of recovery and maintenance where, for me, I go to a therapist once a week. I've been doing that for the last 6 years since I moved out here. I haven't missed an appointment. It's part of my life. I do ERPs daily, mentally, small ones. You know, I don't let myself, or I try not to let myself fall back into bad habits, because I know that without that, I have nothing. So that has to come first for me. And so it's become a lifestyle, you know, managing my mental health. And because of that, you know, I don't have certainty, but I'd like to believe that, you know, the rest of my life will be filled with life and not so much OCD.
Yeah, good. And
yeah, I think, you know, that's one of the reasons that acceptance and commitment therapy has got some traction, I think, in the OCD community, is that exposure response prevention. So we keep alluding to it. For people that don't know the specifics of it, it is really basically a face your fears therapy. If you're afraid of dogs, you need to spend some time with dogs. Every time you see a dog, if you run from a dog, you're going to stay anxious about dogs. If you stick around a dog and don't do anything to protect yourself, you find out dogs aren't what your brain was lying to you and saying all dogs are always going to be dangerous. Same basic principle in OCD treatment. What I found for a lot of folks is they became so preoccupied with, I'm in so much pain, I need to make this pain go away, that the treatment turns into kind of an anti-anxiety attitude. We need to make all this anxiety go away. And what you're losing in that is the fact that even if you don't have OCD, I don't have OCD, I have anxiety, I have stress, I have depression, I have anger, I have different things that go on in my life. I have to learn how to manage those in the context of having a life. And what I like about the message from the acceptance and commitment therapy community is, while we're working on the suffering that you're experiencing, it's in the service of what? So it isn't just let's reduce your OCD symptoms. It's we're reducing your OCD symptoms because you want to live your life in a particular way. And keeping that kind of values-based direction very present in your mind about, I'm not just doing this exposure. I'm not just challenging myself. I'm not just making myself anxious. I'm doing this to clear out room to engage in my life in the way that I would choose to.
I was going to interrupt, and then I turned it into a yawn, which was way more offensive. but I actually want to piggyback on what Jeff said. You know, it's part of my personal story. And by the way, if people want to hear more about my story, if you just Google Ethan Smith keynote, my whole keynote from 2014 is on there. Mm-hmm. And I talk about this. But for me, after 10 months of intensive daily ERP, ACT was the game changer for me. And I'm not in any way saying that ERP doesn't work or that it's just where I was after my own history. And for me, ACT sort of changed my way of thinking. It gave me a new relationship with my thoughts. And it really put into perspective what I had been doing and what I should be doing differently. And it didn't feel like it was attacking me. It felt like it was working with me, and it made things make sense for me. And once that happened, I was able to integrate everything that I learned. And that combination of everything, I believe, really brought me to the state that I'm at today. Yeah. So I'm a huge, huge fan of ACT. ERP is still absolutely the first line gold standard baseline treatment. You know, I don't think ACT is where you should go first. But as a complementary therapy and something to turn to, definitely, if it's, you know, a patient is refractory to ERP, I am sold, and I think it's extremely beneficial. And frankly, and as you know, if you know anything about ACT, and people can Google this, I don't think you need to suffer from a mental illness to benefit from ACT. Yes. It's an amazing – I mean, ACT is basically mindfulness, and that's what's been being preached currently. Mindfulness is very hip and in and trendy right now, you know, and so – I'm a huge fan of ACT. I think it's brilliant.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think obviously there's no replacement for an ACT therapist. But if you're doing ERP, you don't need an ACT therapist or an ERP therapist who is trained in ACT. If for what I've found, if you just read like The Worry Trap by Chad Lejeune or Get Out of Your Mind and Into Your Life by Stephen Hayes, those two books will give you enough of the knowledge that you can apply with your ERP or CBT therapist.
And if you're in therapy and you love your therapist, you don't want to switch, even like buying one of those books and going through it together is really, really helpful. And just learning about it together and being able to discuss it and talk about it.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Thanks guys. This is some brilliant advice. And also hopefully people are now way more familiar with the charity and what you guys do in detail. And I'll put all the links and stuff on the site. Yeah, thanks for what you're doing. I'll be in San Francisco in July, so I'll see you guys.
We look forward to seeing you. Thank you for having us.
Absolutely.
Hey, guys. So I really hope you enjoyed that, and now you fully understand better what the IOCDF do and can do for you and how you can get involved with them. The OCD Stories book is out, and you can find that by going on Amazon, or you can go to the website in the show notes of this episode, and you'll see a link for the book. Thank you so much for your support. And I hope you enjoy this. And this is another way of adding value to you guys. Speak to you soon.